we are joined here in studio by Dr. Stephen Phillips, who is professor in the history department and former director of Asian Studies at Towson University, professional lecturer at the Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies in Washington. Good to have you in the studio, Steve. Excuse me.
Thank you very
much.
Good
to have you in the studio, Steve.
Thank you.
And we're also joined by Tin Chung, who is co-author of Entrepreneurship and Economic Growth in China. She is a research research assistant professor at the Jacob France Institute Merrick School of Business, University of Baltimore. And Tin Chung, welcome. Good to have you with us as well.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
I'm glad you're here. 410-319-8888. Quick question off the block here to both of you. Given our relationship with China, it seemed to be an odd choice for Ed Snowden to decide to go to Hong Kong, where Steve, we have a pretty tight extradition treaty when it comes to things like this.
It's raising all kinds of questions, not the least of which is he discussed going to Hong Kong because it's free and open. Compared to China, it's free, open, and transparent. But compared to Japan, South Korea, the European Union, Australia, so people are sort of raising questions. Does he actually think he might end up going to China, which, of course, would destroy any claim he has that his efforts were about freedom? There's a big mystery about this right now. Why to choose Hong Kong of all the places? It's only slightly freer than China, but you wouldn't call it the beacon of internet and freedom of speech.
Tin Chung, any thoughts on that before we move into the heart of the matter here?
Well, I have a little bit of a different perspective in the sense that because China and as well as the United States are the biggest economic power, so choose Hong Kong has a rationale behind it, and also compared with mainland China, Hong Kong has the history of international trade and commercialization. So that gives a good entryway or gateway to the Chinese economy and Chinese market. So I think that's possibly what works better than some other locations in Asia.
You want to lead us off here, Dr. Spence, with a thought about how we launch into our conversation about the power of China in this world today?
Yeah, so there's an article in that starts out with the title by Robert Fogel, $123, trillion dollars, China's estimated economy by the year 2040. Be warned. In order to indicate the size of China. And that number is far larger than the global economy right now. So I wanted to talk about, so when you guys hear a number like that, assuming that I got the zeros right.
Yeah.
What do you guys think about that?
I'm always very, very skeptical of those sort of things because the articles that get so much attention take the period of highest Chinese growth and just assume it will continue forever. Yeah. The pattern for most countries is when they're poor, they get rich or at least reach the middle very quickly with incredible growth, and then the growth slows down a great deal. And so a lot of the scare numbers you see, I'm pretty skeptical about. Those numbers also tend to assume that China's rising wages aren't going to cause jobs to leave. I was in Vietnam 2 years ago, and on the way from the airport into Hanoi, huge numbers of factories. And when I asked, where are all these factories from? Southern China. And so I think if you take the best years of China, go straight out, mm-hmm. China takes over the world. But do you think that China's growth is going to continue forever? And do you think that other countries aren't going to also offer low-wage labor in order to get into manufacturing? Mm-hmm. So I think the numbers sometimes are overstated.
Tin Chung, what's your take?
I totally agree on that part. I think that number, first of all, is very, very much questionable. I think the whole world kind of overemphasized the power of China in the economic world. And yes, indeed, China developed very well in the past decade and a very strong growth. However, there is a cost for that growth. And the infrastructure and the social economic problems internally has been emerging. So even if China right now is still growing fast, and also we can see, like even from the articles, we see China have a strong image of international purchasing in the global market, but that's mainly backed by the state, not really from the internal demand driven. So from the economic point of view, inside China there are still a lot of issues. So that would result in the next decade or two, how strong China can grow, it's a big problem. So therefore, with that number showing there, I believe that's based on the previous previous decade's growth rate. So that number could be very much questionable. China has its own a lot of challenges coming up.
So before we go into our next question, let me go to the phones here, 410-319-8888. And Brad, you're on the air.
Yeah, I recently was reading an article on the internet that said China can now purchase T-bills, treasury bills, direct from the treasury, which bypasses, you know, if I want to buy a T-bill, I have to go through a broker. And we were discussing, you know, the power of China in the economic world.
Mm-hmm.
And that seems to me that our government has given China, you know, an economic edge that nobody else has. I don't know of any other country. So I'd like to ask the person you have on, you know, what they think about it and how that could affect us as Americans and what kind of leverage that gives the Chinese government where they can purchase T-bills direct from the Treasury.
I'd say the Chinese have been disappointed about how little leverage they get out of the purchases
for a couple of reasons.
Uh-huh. Number one, if you think of the explosion of Chinese economic power, purchasing T-bills, holding a huge amount of our debt, some of that you might say, well, that's an effort to manipulate the U.S. or to have something to hold over the U.S. On the other hand, what else would you have bought in the last 10 years? Yen? Euro? Recognize that some of this is not a great Chinese plot to control America. It's a country with vast amounts of money. Every time they buy natural resources, they drive the price up and kill themselves. Other currencies aren't doing well. Their threats about harming the U.S. because of this have blown up in their face every time. If they do start to sell it off, the value will collapse overnight and hence kill them as much as us. And so the other factor to mention is Japan holds almost as much in T-bills as China does. We're not worried about Japan doing anything. And the United States holds much more of our T-bills than either of those. So I think that's a way for China to pound on its chest, make some threats. But really, what can they do? Cause a global meltdown? What can they do? You know, hurt the United States economy? I think they have much less leverage than perhaps they thought when they got into this game.
Tin Chong, same viewpoint or different?
I actually agree on that point as well. And also, the China buy T-bill, not just from the United States. And the reason for that is not just because China want to expand their power, but also the United States and as well as European countries have a need for attracting investment from China. And as Professor Phyllis, right, and pointed out, in Japan also hold a lot of T-bill, and I basically perceive from a lot of media articles, China's power is really be over exaggerated, and because of China has so much internal issues and so many problems, China's growth won't be a major threat for the United States. It's just some political game. That's what I perceive.
Go ahead, Steve.
I just pointed out who's China probably the biggest economic threat to? And I would argue it's the third world. It's Mexico, Vietnam, Philippines, Indonesia, countries with low wages that want to export to the developed world. And so if you look at what countries have probably been hurt worse by China's rise, it's countries that would love to sell goods to the United States, Japan, and the European Union. They're the ones beat out by low Chinese wages and vast Chinese factories that produce things at a lower price. Unless you think those jobs are coming back to the United States, maybe it's a question of what country gets them overseas. And right now, China's getting them.
Mm-hmm. So my question is, before just back in, I mean, to push a tad further, though, I mean, when the articles I've been reading, just thinking about this program coming up, and you see that China, and with the vast amount of money they have, and they have this ability to do things that, unlike America in some ways, because it is a state capitalist nation.
Yep.
I guess in the old-fashioned definition would be fascist, but that's another question. but it is a state capitalist nation. And going after buying Smithfield Foods, Club Med, the deep investment where the United States couldn't make it in Iraq, in oil, and other investments in oil around the globe. It's the leading exporter in the world, investing huge amounts of money in both Africa, the continent of Africa, and in throughout Latin America. So this is not kind of and we're international capital right now is completely intertwined. Indian, Chinese, Western European, American capital are intertwined in many ways. There are still national interests that kind of confuse all that. So what does that future tell us about what might be the conflicts in our future? They may be economic. They could be military, maybe not. But I'm just curious. I mean, this is not as simple as that, is it, Steve?
No. It's going to be very, very it's been a good decade, I guess you could say, for pariah states thanks to China. Zimbabwe, Sudan, Iran, and for a while Burma. That's where China's economic power, you know, combined with its political power, is really having a lot of influence. I mean, when you would say, well, are, you know, is China, you know, stopping the spread of democracy? Is it promoting oppressive governments? Its ability to work with or willingness to work with those governments with no strings attached.
No, exactly.
The United States and European Union, Japan have all sorts of rules about how projects have to treat the people right, some semblance of law and order. China goes in, often gives money directly to a government, not to NGOs, and doesn't really worry too much about corruption, doesn't worry about political oppression at all. And you have to face up to the fact there are a lot of governments in the world that love that. They hate that the Americans, Europeans, and Japanese have requirements, have standards, want to know how the money is spent. I'm not saying Americans aren't corrupt, but there's at least some rules and some expectations. And I think you have to recognize how many countries in the world love to welcome someone who shows up with money, doesn't ask too many questions, and builds giant projects that make your country look powerful.
And those projects are huge, Tim Chong. So is this, not, so that this is something that the West should not be concerned about?
By the way, just now for that part, in addition to Western countries tend to impose certain standard, which could be on the positive side, but as well as it could be on the negative side as political interference. So that's why a lot of those countries feel very much uncomfortable, and China win an edge.
Now, I have a question, a slightly different question. So when I think about China now, what I just had this image from reading and then from friends who do business in China of these huge cities, that are unpopulated. China is building cities at a rate, like from scratch, that we haven't really seen before in the modern era.
Like Columbia on steroids.
Yeah, like 12 to 24 cities, whole cities a year.
Right.
So that requires a significant labor corps, right? And also requires new building techniques. What are the possibilities that China's needs will in? What are the possibilities that China's needs give for progressive movements, right? So, what are the possibilities that those interested in a new labor movement, or those interested in kickstarting a new green economy? What are the possibilities that China's growth lends to these to individuals interested in these causes?
That's interesting. Well, let's start with Tin Chong this round and go to Steve. Tin?
Yeah, I think this basically China in the last decade, even if there is a lot of economic problem, but it's driven by urbanization. So there is a huge demand for like building huge cities or urban sprawl. So in that case, that meets the should meet the demand of Chinese economic growth. And for the green economy wise, I think Chinese government right now is very much aware of the environment problem, and they try really hard, and even the socially responsible like investment, all those funds are emerging, those efforts are emerging. So I would say the new huge cities and they're going to build, and even for the old current cities, they really have a lot of efforts try to make it green. And also that goes to why China buys so much energy. A big reason, like we know China purchases a lot of solar and energy, that the reason of that, China is highly aware of the sustainability issue and the importance of a green economy.
I have a slightly more cynical perspective, which is, you know, China, you mentioned the ability of social movements and progressive movements. You know, if the party wants it and it's from within the Chinese Communist Party, it's acceptable. But I would point out environmentalists who ask too many uncomfortable questions about state-owned enterprises and such, and an independent labor movement, crushed on a regular basis. And so this is, it, I would say from outside the party, if anything, the last 10 years, those things have been cracked down upon more and more. China has all the laws that you would want about environmental protection, probably as many as the United States, and probably look as good as the United States or Sweden or pick any other country. It's a problem of corruption and enforcement of the laws. And that's why Beijing has some of the worst air pollution in the world, problems of water shortages and water quality, huge problems. And the long-term cancer threat out there is truly horrendous for China. So the laws are there, but the political will to do it, because in the short run, you just want your state-owned enterprises to make money, and you're not going to risk stirring up an environmental movement by moving too far that way. So on big projects like solar panels, you'll see a lot of talk and progress. But on boring things like communities being allowed to oppose a business that's polluting, not a lot of progress.
What about the labor issue, though? Increased urbanization usually attends or happens around the same time that you have increased social movement capacity.
China's worked very hard at keeping that under control, to put it mildly. One aspect that facing China will be not that valiant union organizers can get together because they would be thrown in jail, but China's slowing population growth appears to be driving wages up. That may help China's workers. But as far as the ability of an independent union to be formed that might stand up to, say, a state-owned enterprise or much less the government, I think that's very unlikely now. If anything, those that get crushed. The only thing that's helping workers is the one-child policy. The legacy of that is their labor force may have stopped growing in the last couple of years, might be moving labor costs up.
So, Qin Chang, a final thought from you.
I think for sure the population is always a big issue, and in a sense, economy, a population is always the destiny of the economy. I truly believe that. But I do not think the population, the one-child policy, is the drive for the wage to go up. It's more of an economic reason. And also for the environmental issue, yes, I agree with you. China does have a kind of we call it state capitalism. I agree with that, and because of that, there are a lot of internal, structural reform that is needed. Chinese leaders know that, aware of that, but it's hard to implement because of the system, institutional barrier, including the legal barrier as well. That might have impact on the environment, but on the other hand, the Chinese government, they also realize the environmental issues are very important for sustainability. So on that part, the enhanced awareness and further reform, I think that part will be mitigated. It won't have as a serious problem as we see right now. And also, please be aware that China is relatively new in economic growth. And if you look at the United States, many decades ago, environmental problem was largely ignored decades ago as well. So for those in China, as a fast growth economy, a lot of those social, even political problems still need time to catch up. But I do agree with you, because China has the state capitalism system there is the reach out for the political conflict and problem to be solved is limited. And that could be a potential problem in the long run. For the labor issue-wise, Chinese new government, Xi Jinping already mentioned that it's important. One of his structural reform is attacking the hukou, which is the residence registration system. Try to give people more mobility to move around and have stability in the residence. So that will liberate some of the labor, movement freedom, and make the labor issue less of the problem, and also mitigate the problem of the urbanization China is facing right now. The major cities are already being overcrowded.
Qin Chang, thank you. I know, Steve, you have a slightly different viewpoint on that. Very quickly.
I would just point out that the difference between China and much of the rest of the world is the United States had society and free press, and a better comparison, even Japan from the 1950s and 60s. We know about some of the horrible environmental problems they had, but they had opposition parties, activists, and a press that could make government miserable. China's problem is, as far as solving things is, can you get people who aren't officials to be allowed to talk and to make government unhappy and uncomfortable? And we're not there yet with China.
So we have to take a break here. And I do want to thank Dr. Stephen Phillips. This has been a really fascinating way to kind of get to this bottom line. We'll bring you both back. Yeah. Professor of History in the History Department and former Director of Asian Studies at Towson University, professional lecturer at the Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies in Washington, and Dr. Qin Chang, who is co-author of Entrepreneurship and Economic Growth in China and is a research assistant professor at the Jacob France Institute Merrick School of Business at the University of Baltimore. Qin Chang and C. Phillips, thank you both so much. It's really been enlightening.
Oh, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Looking forward to having you both back. And Dr. Spence and I will be right back as we talk about Dr. Homer Favor, who passed away Saturday, with two people who knew him well. Please stay with us.
Baby, I'll raise up my hand. I mean, I'll do for you.